I'm very fortunate this morning to be speaking with Guillermo Garcia Sanchez, and he is talking about a new paper that he has coming out in the Seton Hall Law Review, which is titled "When Pipelines Cross Indigenous Lands in the American in the Americas." So it's a very hot topic, a very exciting topic, and we're going to talk with him a little bit today about some of the challenges that come from clean energy investment when you're considering both the rights of the international system that protects the rights of investors and the international human rights norms that protect the rights of indigenous peoples. And so, Emma, why don't you just start by telling me a little bit about your new paper?
Thank you so much, James. And thank you for inviting me to participate in this blog. I'm really excited. So this is an important topic because if you think about it, Mexico went through an energy reform a couple of years ago. And by energy, I really talk about energy because it wasn't only about oil and gas. It wasn't just only about opening the sector to private investors to come and participate. It was more about producing energy in a more efficient and in a more bringing Mexico to current 21st century standards of production, right? Reducing greenhouse gas emissions, reducing inefficiencies that were left over after, you know, Mexico was closed for 70 years. So when the signers of the energy reform were really thinking about how do we diversify our sources of production? So this included building more solar panels, building more wind farms, diversifying the oil fields. And all of that was in place. So it allows now private producers to come in to Mexico and feed the grid, sell energy to CFE. One of the things that people didn't really think about it through enough was how do you explain what is happening in terms of transitioning to the communities that are going to be affected by all this new infrastructure? And it's particularly because, as it happens in most North America, a lot of these pipelines, a lot of these farms, a lot of these solar panels have to be built on indigenous lands. And usually these are communities that are the most vulnerable. I mean, they've already been deprived of many resources. They've been moved around, taking their lands away. And the existing two regimes that we have in place to address the questions of how do you balance the new infrastructure, the new investment vis-a-vis how do you balance the rights of indigenous communities are not talking to each other. And so on the one hand, you have the human rights regime that protects indigenous rights and gives them a right to receive prior and informed consultation before any project is being built. But on the other hand, you also have the rights of foreign investors to receive full protection and security for their investments and receive a fair equitable treatment. And, you know, the government also pledges to respect their legitimate expectations that their project and any amount of money that they put into place, you know, is going to yield the results and yield the benefits in the long run.
So that's really important to understand. So, although the current Mexican government, sometimes called populist, sometimes compared to the current American government, one difference is that Mexico is still committed to its Paris Agreement reduction. So it is planning to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. And, like most countries that are looking to cut their greenhouse gas emissions, that means trying to get coal and oil out of the power system. And so their natural gas is an opportunity because it has lower greenhouse gas emissions in both coal and oil. And so, for that reason, as well as for economic reasons, Mexico has been transitioning to use more natural gas to meet its power demand.
We tend to talk about, when you read about the literature on energy justice and energy democracy, we talk about the consumer side of things, right? How the consumers can select clean energies and what is it good for consumers to receive more information and participate more in the decision-making process of where the energy that is being consumed in their communities is coming from. But when you think about it, we have to have a conversation about the communities that are being affected by those clean energies, right? Because that clean energy is coming from somewhere. So the case of Sempra is a great example. Mexico is transitioning into producing most of its power from LNG. So it's gas. right? So they're trying to bring either LNG through the ports or building pipelines to bring gas that's being produced in Texas and feeding the Mexican grid. That's a great thing for Mexico because gas is cheaper, is less pollutant. But the bad thing is that those pipelines have to cross through communities, right? And in the case of Mexico, many of them are indigenous communities. So the case of Sempra is a great example because, and so they were able to build the pipelines that were bringing the gas from Mexico, and everybody was running great. But the problem is that they bump into lands, tribal lands, and the Mexican government didn't do a good job into doing the consultation process that was required by the law and by international standards. So ultimately what you have is the communities ended up bringing claims against the Mexican state, both at the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and to the Mexican Supreme Court. And on the other hand, you had a fight between Sempra and the Mexican government to comply with the contract, right? And that ended up in an arbitration process. So the Mexican government basically was facing suddenly two claims, right? They had either to compensate investors or to compensate the communities for being affected. No matter what they did, they were going to end up paying. And that's this reveals the tension that both regimes ended up putting into place, right? And from the government perspective, if you think about it, it's all about the long-term benefits of the projects and also about reducing the amount of compensation you have to pay. In the case of Sempra, the Mexican government owns Sempra $3 billion. Imagine, $3 billion, just because they didn't do the right the consultation process well, because from the company's perspective, they had built the infrastructure. And that was, it was the government's fault, and so they were already going to be charging the regular fee as if the pipeline was operating. But from the Mexican perspective, we're paying for something that is not being delivered, and the communities at the same time have a right to bring their claims and protest, and we just can't just bulldozer them over. So you ended up, a lot of tensions ended up happening, people ended up being killed, and the company, ultimately the Mexican government negotiated with Sempra, and they were able to reduce the deal, but the pipeline.
And so were these, and were the people were killed, were that sort of unsolved murders, or was it?
So what happens in many of these cases is that you have a number of communities, right? And this is another problem with the right of consultation, because the law only specifies that the communities have to be consulted, but it doesn't define what a community is.
And are you talking about Mexican law or international human rights?
Both. I would say Mexican law, there is a process to be recognized as an indigenous community under the Mexican Constitution. But international law only talks about communities, right? And it leaves it up to the states to identify them. So what ends up happening is that you have communities and towns that are fully indigenous, but then you have colliding towns that that are mixed, right? So they have a group of people that come from the indigenous communities or come from different tribes, and you have a group of people that aren't really indigenous communities but live in the same in the same towns. And so one of the tensions that you have is that sometimes the pipeline crosses to the three communities. And so the first two might agree, right? And they might have an elected official that it's their own tribe representative, and he might agree with the pipeline and agree with the compensation. But you might have the third community that says no, because maybe they have a more traditional view of land. Maybe they have a connection with the desert and with the forest that is totally different from these mixed communities. So they have different views. So the regime ends up putting them also into fight. And so you have a lot of fights even within the communities. The communities end up, you know, imposing each other's views and trying to decide how to come up with a consensus. And it's a difficult thing to do. And from the company's perspective, sometimes they don't know who they are supposed to be negotiating. The level of engagement you can have with different communities varies enormously on whether those communities are located near urban areas or whether these communities are isolated in the forest. But some of the communities, they just don't want to have any impact in their lives. Because if you think about it, it has happened in the past. And some of the cases that I've analyzed in Ecuador, once you build a road, once you build a new port, once you build a new hospital, you change the dynamic inside the community so much that they lose their identity, right? People start migrating, women are left with kids. At the same time, when you build a decent hospital, there's less mortality rate, so you increase the amount of population. And so that eventually pushes the community also to start doing illegal lumbering. I mean, the amount of impacts that you can have ultimately has down the line a bunch of effects on the community that we just can't measure right now. And that could even be happening not only about oil and gas projects, it's pipelines, it's wind farms. The case of Oaxaca and the Istmo, it's very representative because the community there took for a while for the community to accept the construction of a wind farm. So Oaxaca is a state that has the most amount of indigenous communities. Almost, I think it's 50-60% of the state is indigenous. So no matter what you do in Oaxaca, you're going to bump into a community. And the Istmo is a great, it's out in Mexico, and it's amazing for wind. I mean, it's called, you know, that area in Spanish called the Ventosa, because it's just the amount of wind flips trucks over. Because it's right located in a valley where both the winds from the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific meet. And there's mountains on both sides. So it's just basically like a funnel. So that's a great example. I mean, the Oaxaca example, the Mexican government actually selected Oaxaca to be one of the first consultation processes because they thought, well, you know, it's green energy, right? Who's going to be against building a wind farm in south of Mexico? Of course, the communities are going to be excited. And guess what? The communities were not excited when they start seeing like the winds being built there, the mills being built there. At first, they thought, you know, some of the communities were thinking, why are they taking away the air? It looks terrible. I mean, physically, it's imposing, right? It's not necessarily something. I think only people in Denmark and the Netherlands are excited to see them. And I've seen them. I mean, they're beautiful. But for people that have never seen that massive infrastructure being built, they didn't understand what was happening. They didn't understand the trade-offs. And it took a while for the government to negotiate with them and have them understand that there actually was clean energy and they were actually going to be benefiting from that. And one of the key elements that helped the government to convince them that it was a good thing is that they were able to reduce how much the communities were paying for their own bills, for their own energy consumption. That was one of the big criticisms. Oh, so you're going to building this so you can feed Mexico City, you can feed all the urban areas, and we're still going to be paying higher energy prices? How is that beneficial for us? So ultimately, the government was like, okay, we'll reduce it, and we'll provide almost free energy for the communities. So that's one of the challenges. I mean, technically, it's the government who has to do the consultation process, and then the government talks to the companies and trying to figure out the process, but the companies are also in place. For the companies, The immediate idea is we'll pay whatever you need us to pay, right? We'll put in some money and we build the infrastructure or whatever is needed. But from the government's perspective, it's not only about building stuff, it's how do you maintain them? Because that's what happened in the past. I mean, you build a new hospital. Who's going to keep the hospital? The companies, the government, the local municipality. So it's not as simple as that. And also the community, sometimes reaching a consensus within the communities of what they want in exchange, it's a challenge, because if you think about it, going back to the idea that you cannot treat the same communities that is in an urban setting vis-a-vis the communities that live in more isolated places, because they have a different connection with the land and with the forest and with the fauna that is not easily compensable, right? You're chopping down trees that are medicinal trees connected to the way of life, the way they educate their children, the way they connect with their own food and with their own production. That's never compensable. I mean, even you can throw as much money you want into it, that's never going to be enough for the communities. It always ends up being that it's easier for the government to side on the side of the company. I mean, if there's a clash of rights, if the communities are blocking infrastructure, it has already been accepted, and the companies are bringing complaints to the government, it's easier for the government just to, okay, we're going to benefit the company because this is in the long run, it's going to help us with our energy plan, and it's going to be cheaper. So James, as you can see, there's no easy answer here in the sense that the existing two regimes really are almost in tension, and the government is left in the middle with ultimately a wrong decision. So in the paper, I propose ultimately that we have to start a dialogue among investment scholars and investment practitioners and human rights activists and human rights scholars, because ultimately seeing those two regimes as separate, as not having a connection with each other, I think it's not helpful both for the communities and for the companies, because ultimately also the companies, they don't want to bump into these kind of cases. I mean, it's a worse scenario because it affects their reputations, affects the timelines of their projects, it affects the way they structure their investments. So for me, a lost opportunity, for example, was the USMCA. I mean, at some point, Canada had proposed to include the right of indigenous communities into the text of the agreement, so it would be contemplated as part of the investors' chapter. And Mexico.
This is the U.S. Mexico-Canada agreement that is the successor to the North American Free Trade Agreement. So it's correct. NAFTA version 2.
The NAFTA 2.0 now with lactose and a bunch of new things. but ultimately, they wanted to include that, and it was rejected by Mexico and the United States. But I think it was a great mistake. I mean, this is a conversation that should be in the treaties themselves, so that investors know that if they bump into trouble, they already knew that they had to comply with those kind of rights and contemplate them in their investments. Otherwise, this is not going to work out. And from the indigenous, from the human rights perspective, I think human rights scholars also have to understand more how the energy companies think and how they structure. They're not always the bad evil. And I think this is a great way also to a trade-off argument. Now we have to have a conversation with energy producing companies that are also trying to bring cleaner energy into the markets, right? And so it's not only a conversation about the good guys and the bad guys. I think that binary reaction, I think, is not helpful for both sides. But we just haven't had an opportunity to sit down and talk. And I think the paper was an invitation to do that, to start talking about it as belonging to the same field.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this paper also addresses, you know, how the similar questions are arising in Canada and the United States, and how there are, you know, potentially, you know, if it's a cross-border solution, maybe it could address these issues across North America. I wanted to ask you, I know that together we're working on this new research project that is being supported by the Texas-Mexico Center at SMU on cross-border energy trade. And I just wonder how this article fits into that work.
I think it definitely fits into part of the research because it generates uncertainty, right? When you don't have a clear framework to deal with communities and work with the communities, from the perspective of a company, it's going to generate the same uncertainty as regulatory changes because you don't know if eventually the government is going to do the right job in consulting with the communities and obtaining their consent. Because that's the other thing. Ultimately, the way international law defines the right of consultation, it has to be done in a prior way, informed, and it has to be in good faith. But ultimately, it's not a veto, right? It has to be, the aim has to be consent, getting the consent, but it doesn't require the consent of the communities. So, you know, ultimately, I think this is definitely part of the research, and I hope we'll be able to talk more about it as we develop the project.
All right. Well, Guillermo, thank you so much. This has been so much fun, and appreciate you coming here to talk with us on energy trade-offs.
Thank you, James.